It's an experience which I suspect I share with a number of people in this room. The sudden and somewhat disturbing realization that you're old enough and have been around long enough to become a historical source is a kind of turning point in one's life. It means that one of the other features of getting old is that it means that you can remember roughly, anyway, what happened 30 or 40 years ago, but you can't really remember something that you were told 5 minutes ago. So I'm going to ask the panel in a minute to introduce themselves rather than risk getting it all wrong. I think I can just a bit about remember enough about myself to introduce myself. So I'm John Hamer. Most of what I have to say about myself is now prefaced by the word previously. So I was previously a history teacher, I was previously an HMI, and I was previously education advisor to the Heritage Lottery Fund. Something which I imagine my former HMI colleagues will be sympathetic to is that moving from being an HMI to going to the Heritage Lottery Fund was a bit like moving, I imagine, a bit like moving from the Inquisition to being one of Father Christmas's little elves, that people actually gave parties when you arrived rather than when you left. So it was very good for my psyche. That's me. So I said I'm going to ask the panel to introduce themselves in a minute. You will notice as they go through the introductions that there are three members of the panel from village colleges in Cambridgeshire. So I suspect there must be something in the air in Cambridgeshire which makes for good history teachers, and indeed two of them are from the same college. That's very welcome, but slightly unexpected, in that one of the original members of the panel did have to cry off. So that's the reason for that. But as I say, I'll ask the panel to introduce themselves, and then we'll move on to the test that you have set. I'm happy to say them rather than me. Thank you. So,
hi, my name is Garrett Brown, and I am a history AST and advanced skills teacher for Cambridgeshire. I work in a village college just outside Cambridge, and a day a week I work in other schools in Cambridgeshire, helping to support developments in history teaching. And I've been teaching history for about 17 years.
Hello, I'm Michael Fordham. I'm head of history at Cosnan Village College in Cambridgeshire as well. I have been teaching for 5 years, so I'm probably certainly the youngest person on this panel. I mentor trainee teachers. In fact, a couple of my trainee teachers are in the audience today, so I don't feel like I'm the youngest person here. I do a lot of work with the Faculty of Education in Cambridge. I'm an editor of the journal Teaching History and do some work with the Historical Association in that sense. And possibly, really useful to talk about later, is that I'm also an A-level examiner.
Thank you. Steve?
I'm Steve Mastin. I'm head of history, citizenship, politics, and classics now at Sawston Village College in Cambridgeshire. My empire's growing, as my SLT keep reminding me. I am also someone who's taught in both private and state sectors. I started my career teaching in a boarding school in Cambridge, left because the quality of history teaching was appalling, and moved to the state sector, and I have not regretted that for one day. I suppose I should also come clean and say that as well as being head of history, I'm also a member of the Conservative Party and the Conservative Education Society, and stood for Parliament at the last election.
Thank you, Steve. Catherine?
I'm Catherine McElroy. I'm a past teacher. I work in a primary school in Smethwick in the West Midlands, and I've been teaching since 1975 when I started teaching in Stroud in Gloucestershire. I write partly for Primary History, which is a publication from the HA. I'm on their primary committee, but I'm here as a history teacher myself today.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you for that. You'll notice that in order to make the test slightly easier, we've seen the questions in advance. And so rather than pass the microphone round for questions, we have a number of questions here for the panel to respond to. But if there are supplementaries, please just show and we can, I hope, address those. So if you want to ask further questions or expansion on any of the points that the panel make, please do indicate. So, just to start the proceedings, the first question, would the panel agree that history teaching is currently extremely strong in secondary schools and that further tinkering with national curriculum, GCSE, etc., would hinder or hamper the good progress that is being made? So we'll start from the other direction this time, Catherine.
Right. Well, I'm sure the teaching in secondary schools is extremely good in many schools. I really only talk about primary sector.
We'll add primary
and
as well.
You know, it's the good success of the secondary schools that build on the excellent work in primary schools, hopefully. I think tinkering, I don't want to get into the argument about tinkering with the curriculum at secondary schools necessarily. I just feel that there needs to be a continuity and a link between primary and secondary so that there is a good strength built through the system. I don't really want me to add anything else to that.
Steve.
I think teachers are used to change, and we get a bad reputation for complaining whenever anyone suggests changing anything in education. But I'm not sure that's particularly fair. I don't mind change at all in education. The history conferences that I go to, the history teachers that I talk to, if I come across a new and an innovative, creative idea, I want to use it in my classroom the next day. I want to change what I'm doing to make it better. So history teachers love changing things to improve the way in which they teach and to improve pupils' experience of history. I think teachers have also become very used to change for change's sake. And without sounding too political, I think the last 10, 13 years, we've experienced change annually, new initiatives, new strategies that have never really been seen through. And that's something that I don't like about the tinkering with education. When it comes to the history curriculum, I think the most striking thing, although there are several wonderful things about this book that Sir David and Nicola and Jenny have produced, one of the most striking things for me is that the problem is not with the history curriculum. This book is not arguing that there should be wholesale rewriting and tinkering with the curriculum. The problems are very different, and they will come up in questions that we've been asked. But tinkering with the system, change for change's sake, we're used to change. Change is not a bad thing if it's improving. If it's simply to change things because a new government is in power or because the Secretary of State wants to make his or her mark, then I'm opposed to change for that reason.
Thank you. Michael.
We play a game with the Year 7 students in my school, 11 years old, and it's called the generalisation game. And what we do is we give them historical generalisations, when someone said something about history, and we get them to hold up a sign that says, too simple. And, as ever with history, there's always something which is too simple. It's always more complex than you at first think it is. And I think that applies to history teaching as well. And I was listening to Mr. Gove's talk this morning, and I just wanted to have my sign to hold up and say this is too simple, because history teaching in many schools in this country is excellent. It's one of the best taught subjects in the country. We know that because Ofsted tell us that. We know that because we go out into lots of other schools, we talk to each other, and we see the quality that's there. So we do know that. But that's not to say it's brilliant everywhere. But of course, it wouldn't be. As David said this morning, you know, there are thousands and thousands of schools and tens of thousands of students in this country, and to say that history is excellent everywhere would be too simple. So I'm not going to sit here and say that history is absolutely fantastic in every school in the country, but it's certainly fantastic in quite a few. And what I'd like to see is that good practice where history is being taught very well being recognised a little bit more and being taken from there, and politicians such as Mr. Gove, journalists, pundits in the media. I'd like to see them listening a little bit more and realising that a lot of what they're saying, frankly, is too simple.
Thank you. Go on.
Thank you. Just to follow that up, I think that it's perhaps like coincidence that we've got different schools from Cambridge, because we might be in a little bit of a bubble in a sense that there is a lot of excellent practice. There's some very good departments in the area, and that's because of its connection perhaps with the Faculty of Education and the kind of access we have to good professional development, something we might talk about later on. But certainly in the work I do as an AST, even within Cambridgeshire, I see quite a variety of practice in particularly the locality of Cambridge, some excellent schools, and I get involved in some fantastic projects which further disseminate best practice. But I travel further afield to areas where they struggle to recruit teachers. I've been working in a school that's been in special measures for some time, and the teaching isn't excellent, and that's mostly because there aren't subject specialists teaching history, and they're not able to recruit subject specialists and keep hold of them. So that's one issue that I see in the work just within my county. In terms of the tinkering issue, I'm sure we'll come back to the issue of the national curriculum again this afternoon. But the worry for certainly amongst the community of history teachers and the discussions we have is the worry about whether there will be, whatever this new curriculum will look like, whether it's a list of prescribed content. We're obviously very keen to get as much content across to our students as possible. But the issue is what they do with that content and keeping history as a discipline. And if the tinkering harms history as a discipline where students are developing their critical faculties in order to think, then that's the worry for us about tinkering. Certainly we'll be losing some great accumulated knowledge that's been developed over many years. But I'm sure we'll return to this point.
I mean, on this point, I was interested to know that the Secretary of State this morning detected a gap between what was actually written down in the national curriculum and what actually happened in history classrooms. So on that basis, any tinkering would be ineffective anyway, because history teachers will continue to go their own way, as I suspect they always have done. There's another question, which a number of questions which are broadly in the area of content, but I think picks up one of the last points that Geraint was making about whether, do you think that history teaching is better served by prescription of content knowledge or free choice of content? So should the Secretary of State or somebody else actually prescribe what the content should be, or alternatively, would we be better off with simply a free choice, as happened in those days when there was no golden age?
I think this is a really nutty issue, really. I started teaching before the national curriculum was established, and I loved being able to prescribe the content of the history teaching in the primary school I was in. And there was very little oversight over whether I chose to do Cotswold Wall Churches or whether I chose to do a project on the Romans. And I'm the sort of person who hates to be told what to do. So when the national curriculum was first brought in, my initial response to it was, I don't want to be told what to do. I want to be able, to, as a professional, to choose what I think is best for the children in my school, with the support of the staff and the head in my school. But having worked since the advent of the national curriculum and through its changes, now my passion at the moment is that all children have a chance to be taught history. And I think we need to stand up for that, and as well as doing that, we need to stand up for what sort of history do we want taught, and what do we mean by the teaching of history. Now, we all bring ourselves to that issue. I would like to see, personally, a local content to history, some national history, some world history, from key stage one up to key stage whatever we get to. I would regret very much if the content was prescribed too prescriptively, and so, you know, year three became medieval, year four became something else, because then the publishers get hold of that and overworked or time-striven teachers can be too tempted to then pursue a narrow path. So I think there needs to be some outline, but within that outline, teachers should also be able to pick and choose. For example, the School of Art at the moment, knowing I was coming here today, I quickly pulled children out yesterday from each of our year groups of primary school and asked them some current things about their teaching history at the moment. And this year, our year six teacher has introduced looking at the Crusades. Now, that's something that we haven't done in primary school for a long time. In fact, it's hard for me to remember when it was last done in primary school. So there needs to be flexibility so that we can be creative with it, but it needs not to be too prescriptive and too laid down. I hope that helps you.
Thank you.
I mean, I think I broadly agree with that. I mean, I grew up under the national curriculum, and I now teach with the national curriculum in place. And I kind of accept what Mr. Gove said this morning, that actually history teachers tend to go and do what they want with it anyway. But to me, that's not a bad thing. Because, let's face it, history teachers are professionals. They are people who have been studying history. They hopefully know quite a lot about history. And therefore, they should have a pretty good sense of what could be taught, what might be taught, and how they go about doing that. So I think a national curriculum is useful for that idea of setting out a framework. So, for instance, saying that all students are entitled to study local history, British history, European history, world history. All students are entitled to a broad chronological span, so that you don't get in some school some non-specialist just teaching something quite narrow. I think that is helpful, but I think that actually history teachers have the professional capacity to be able to say, well, actually, we know quite a lot about history, actually, and we can therefore think about what we're going to teach and how we teach it.
Just to follow that up, what Michael's just described there, of course, is what's in the current national curriculum. We are able to teach, and we are required to teach, a broad span of history from British, European, world perspectives. Of course, there is guidance, and there is plenty of prescription in there. Of course, the media might pick up on issues to do with Churchill's not named, but I think that might be a surprise to some to think that we don't teach about Churchill. Of course, teachers are making choices all the time about what to teach, what not to teach. And just because it's not in the curriculum doesn't mean we don't teach it. So, you know, we do generally have these discussions all the time in the department about keeping our curriculum with a broad chronology of British history, as well as its links to European world history. But the issue of prescription, again, comes back to what I was saying earlier about the curriculum isn't just about the content. Curriculum is about the discipline of the subject and what then the students do with this content, this factual knowledge. And at the moment, the current curriculum that came in 2008 reflects some of the best practice that's been going on in recent years. Obviously, there were issues early on, and it's been developed over time, but we were perhaps lucky in the history community when the new curriculum came out that it did reflect some of this best practice. There were issues, certainly for other subjects, in trying to force them all to adopt the same format in terms of concepts and processes, things that you've probably heard about. So that's the worry for me about prescription, whether it re-established this false division between content and so-called skill. And I think that's something that we'll probably be debating further. So, Steve?
Yeah, I concur with everything that's been said. The national curriculum says very clearly that the study of British history should include the development of power from the Middle Ages to the 20th century, including changes in the relationship between rulers and ruled over time, the changing relationship between crown and parliament, and the development of democracy. It doesn't specify what we should teach. So I'm going to take a gamble here. Michael, you're head of history at a comprehensive school like I am. Do you teach the Normans?
Yep.
It's not in the national curriculum. Do you teach Magna Carta and King John?
Yeah.
Do you teach Elizabeth I?
Yeah.
Do you teach the Civil War?
Yeah.
None of those things are mentioned in the national curriculum. I teach all of those things as well. History teachers are teaching these things that I'm sure Mr. Gove would want us to tick off. We're doing it already. So if you simply put them in the national curriculum document, I'm quite comfortable with that. But to say that we're not teaching them already is ludicrous.
Just to add to that, if you ask a history teacher the opposite question about what they don't teach, they'll be able to give you a list of things as well, I'm sure. But it's not because it's not in the curriculum either. It's because, or even if it were, it's because of a time issue, which has been discussed. Even if there is a very detailed prescriptive list of content that ought to be covered, unless we get the time issue sorted and how much time we have to teach it, it won't be covered. And that's a big problem for schools. And I think we have a question about time as well.
Yeah. I mean, it may be, given the subversive nature of history teachers, that one way of guaranteeing that something isn't taught is to actually put it in the national curriculum. Just about. Another one. There's one more on content. Yes, sorry. Yes, Chris.
Can I just say something about prescription? Because I have here the National Curriculum History Working Group, April 1990, which prescribed, as you talk among other things, Ernst Bendur, Robert Bruce, Bannockburn, the Declaration of Art Broke, Lollardy, clothing and costumes in the Middle Ages, and that's just one page from what you may remember was a fairly extensive document. And I think two things came up. One is that they were widely not taught. Personally, I managed to stick the Declaration of Art Broke into a textbook. I never secondly, it did lead to Ofsted telling us through the immediate years after this that the quality of history teaching in this country actually went down as teachers struggled to make sure every blooming item in here was covered. For fear that an Ofsted inspector was lurking outside the door with a checklist. But what came out of this morning, however, is that while people might seem, even Secretary of State seemed fairly relaxed about East 83, we could be looking at a different and prescriptive East 84, which would be a GCSE course, where you would have to teach everything because your exam results are going to depend on you. You couldn't take that easy, relaxed path if the current two GCSE courses that are widely taught were moved out of the way and a new, more British GCSE course were introduced. And I wonder how members of the panel would react to a GCSE course that was very different, perhaps more British, perhaps more covering a wider span of history, though I regret Secretary of State totally misunderstood the school's history projects, totally worryingly. However, how the panel would react to being told what to do through perforce a single GCSE course, perhaps in a single form.
Yes, I think a misunderstanding that is very, very widespread in the media, and I've heard it from a lot of politicians as well, is that Key Stage 3, what students do between 11 to 14, usually, and GCSE, between 14 and 16, usually, are the same thing. And actually, Mr. Gove even slipped into that himself at one point this morning, when in fact they're not. And of course, the key difference is that Key Stage 3 history is compulsory, and GCSE is not. And if you listen to when people talk about prescription, what they're talking about is, what do we think all citizens in this country should know? Because that's the point of prescription. If everyone's not going to learn it, what's the point in prescribing it? Well, to my mind, that means that actually talking about prescription at GCSE should only come after a conversation about whether GCSE is compulsory. If it's not compulsory at GCSE, then there's no point prescribing for it. So I think the question has to be answered there about prescription at 11, whether students should do history at 14 to 16 needs to come before that. So that would be my initial thoughts on that. Nevertheless, just to answer the point about how would I feel if more British history were to come in, well, you know what I'd do? I'd approach it as a historian. Okay, I've taught the SHP course, I've taught Medicine Through Time, and as Mr. Gove put it, Cowboys and Indians, which is actually a really interesting course in the American West. And I've taught the Modern World course, and I've taught the topics there. And when I came to teach those, having been a medievalist in my background, I had to go and learn new stuff. And I'd approach it in the same way. I'd go and find out what are the genuine historical issues that historians are arguing about. I would go and I would read journals, I would read books, I'd find out what current scholars are writing about the period of history that we're doing. And so if the GCSE curriculum were to change, and to be more focused on, say, British history, well, I've got nothing fundamentally against that, but I would come and approach it as a historian and not in the interest of teaching some national narrative.
That's right. Any other comments on that?
It's interesting about the national curriculum prescribing things, because the academies that are spreading across the country don't have to follow the national curriculum. So if, as Mr. Gove and my government that I support, well, half of it, if...
We'll ask you which half later.
If they want more and more schools to become academies, which I'm not opposed to, but they don't have to follow the national curriculum, then why is there a national curriculum?
Actually, Catherine, do you...
Yes, the thing I wanted to raise was one thing that struck me this morning when I looked particularly at the website and the exercise books. And I've been clearing out my daughter's room recently, and she's now 27, and she did history at secondary school and university. And to my horror, I could have been looking at some of her exercise books when I looked at some of the screens. I think we need to have a debate about what is history. What are we trying to do when we engage our children in learning history? And, you know, are we bringing out good thinking, good debating skills? Are children looking at sources? Are they seeing different points of view? If the GCSE syllabus was changed, then I would like to see in it a local element, a study element for those students to do. It's quite often mentioned at university that students struggle to do independent study because they haven't perhaps done it so much at secondary school. Now, I shouldn't be probably into this debate because my knowledge of secondary education is slim. But there are probably good ways that there could be change. I don't know. I'll just throw it open to debate.
Thank you.
Just for people who perhaps here don't teach history, and we do teach British history at GCSE, and when there was a rewrite of GCSE curriculum not so long ago, and more British history was brought in, we did what we do, as Michael's outlined there. We got on with it. We went and read and enjoyed reading and found out about areas we weren't necessarily experts in, and then really enjoyed sitting down and chewing over how best to teach particular content areas and what to get students to do in terms of the thinking they were doing in class. It's very enjoyable. That's part of the job we love. The issue of prescribing at GCSE has to be thought of as a whole, though, because if we do prescribe at GCSE, bearing in mind we have quite a lot of British history covered at Key Stage 3, it's pointless prescribing it at GCSE and not having another conversation about repetition, because more repetition would happen if it's not thought of as a whole in terms of Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4 and Key Stage 1 and 2.
That's right. Is there anything else, anybody else in the audience who would like to say anything about the prescription issue? Yes, at the back.
Can I use a model from the teaching of RE where each local authority has its sacred board that has set up an agreed syllabus that goes from early years up to Key Stage 5? And having been involved in the project management of the writing of those syllabuses, it is an engaging professional concern, and that allows sense of coherence that goes from early years right through primary into secondary. There is an element of prescription in the sense that you have to do the same as young, but from my experience, it is a professional dialogue that seems to provide a model that offers progression, coherence, links between key stages. That might be something that would allow historians to have professional dialogues that would get around some of these issues.
All right, thank you for that. Perhaps just one, well, a couple more anyway on prescription. Yes.
In 1988, at GCSE, on the AB advisory panel, we set up a full suite of British history GCSEs, including the social and economic one, and the good conservative principles of market forces, free choice applied, and they all died and withered on the vine. So they were there, and they died because the teachers didn't want them, the kids didn't want them, the parents didn't want them. So please, let's look at the history of history education and revisit the 1988 GCSE debate.
Thanks, John. Ben?
Yeah, yeah, actually, John, just to start with the first point I was going to make, which is with regards to the GCSE courses. Most of them, of course, have a range of options that are chosen, or rather, the teachers can choose from. So there's a course that we have to do, and then there's a range of options, excellence, for example, within those courses. And one thing I would say with the secondary stage was that there tends to be a focus on particular ones. So, prescription, I think there's a danger that you sort of you don't want to appear to be too entrenched and resisting all change. But at the same time, I don't think we should be afraid to point out the problems that prescription can bring as well. Not in a bunker mentality sort of way, but just to sort of say, look, if this solution looks attractive, let's just also consider possible unintended outcomes from that solution. So, for example, all of the content areas that have been jumped around here. First of all, nothing is not made with value. With the comments about cowboys and Indians, I fully accept your lack of it. I wasn't very comfortable with that either. But probably you've grown with the audience too. Now, what does that say about, you know, that somehow this is, why is it, if the Secretary of State had said Manchester weavers and Irish immigrants, we've had the same drones. And if not, surely that says something about, you know, just the very label. Content actually have value attached. Then the second thing, of course, is chronology, isn't it? The, you know, every topic area, every, you know, if you do that chronologically, if you're going to prescribe, are you going to prescribe them in a certain order as well? Now, most of us here will scratch our heads and say, oh, blimey, what's that complicated? And I guess that's the answer to this. If you get across the fact that it's complicated, but, yeah, not simple, then I think more than anything, that's the message that we all. And I think that.
Thank you for those comments. Still staying on issues of content, but moving on to A-level rather than GCSE. There was a question about, this question. At A-level, should we offer courses that cover topics the students are familiar with, or should we be offering something outside their experience? A factor in this decision is, of course, that we must sell the subject to maximise numbers. So should we be looking at A-level for courses which are outside the courses that students have already taken, or not?
Well, the only thing I would want to say is that for A-level, what we want to give the students is challenge and enjoyment and success in what they're doing. So to me, it doesn't matter whether they're looking at Anglo-Saxons or Bede, or when they're looking at something from the Industrial Revolution, but are they looking at it, you know, from different angles in depth, and can the students at the end of their A-level course produce a valid argument over what they've learned?
I think I'm right in saying, and I can be corrected on this, that I'm probably, despite being the youngest member of the panel, I probably taught most A-level here, because I worked in an 11 to 18 school before I moved to my current school, which is an 11 to 16 school, at least for history. And the first thing I'd say, having been an A-level examiner as well, is that actually there's a wide range of courses available. And when I was marking A-level scripts and A-level coursework last summer, I was marking things that ranged from the Spanish Civil War to the history of Cyprus. And a lot of schools have chosen to do very interesting studies within the flexibility of what's already there. And okay, the most popular topics, the Russian Revolution, Nazi Germany, and so on, are in there and are done a lot. You know, there's actually quite a wide range already. And one of the most popular topics, as I understand it, that EdXL offer at the moment, is actually about British history between 1815 and 1884. So, you know, there's already a wide range of topics out there. But I'd like to think about this in another way, actually. I mean, the logical step is, if we're going to say about A-level, and let's face it, I don't think anyone at this table here would suggest that all students should be doing A-level, well, we're saying a minority of students doing A-level, and therefore it doesn't apply to everyone. I mean, would we be saying the same thing about university courses? Should we be saying, isn't it awful that Cambridge University don't do this, 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 and this? Or that some other university do this, 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 and this? I mean, I don't think universities would want to start seeing prescription, and actually I'd say the same applies to A-level. What they want to see is good history. And A-level history, whatever topic it is, can be taught as good history. You have the time, you have the hours, you have the depth, you can go into lots of historiography and read lots of books about it, including the students, and it can be a fantastic course. It's a fantastic experience teaching A-level. But I think to go in and say, well, you know, should A-level be prescribed in some way, is kind of missing the point. By the time students get to that age, they should be thinking about what their interests are. And, you know, as I think Ben said just now, it is driven a little bit by supply and demand. You know, the reason that a lot of people study something is because that's what they've chosen to study. I mean, at my last school, we ran two parallel A-level courses, and students could choose between different topics. And they did. And it was therefore their personal choice. Just like when I went to university, I was told I had to do one paper before 1750 and one after. But apart from that, I had a pretty free range in what I chose to study. And I think actually we need to give a little bit more freedom to students there to say that by the time you reach that level of historical study, you should be choosing to study what you're interested in. And okay, there's only so much we can put on offer in terms of teaching, but actually the flexibility is already there. There's a very wide range of A-level topics, and students do study them.
I'll have to be careful. I'm being attacked by members of my own panel. Yes. Geraint.
Yeah, I haven't taught A-level for many years, but one of the things that I'll just bring up is... So we don't get a huge amount of time to spend talking to our local sixth forms that our school feeds into. And that would be helpful, I think, if we had a little bit more time. It's not one site's fault in particular, but it is quite a difficult thing to fit in. And I know that students in our school, for example, they do a unit on Nazi Germany at Key Stage 4. They don't do it at Key Stage 3. There isn't repetition within the school, but I know that is an option that they can do at A-level. I don't know, that's the popular area of concern, is whether they repeat something like the Nazis in their studies. Of course, as Michael's just pointed out, there's a lot of choice in those sixth forms, and one would hope that the teachers are having conversations with their students about what they've studied before and broadening their knowledge of European, British world history. But certainly I think communicating with the secondary schools, and secondary schools communicating with A-levels to find out what's going on would be very helpful too.
That's right.
I think, again, I keep coming back to this landmark book. It's interesting that we finally have a detailed, well-researched answer to the question, was there a golden age of history teaching? And the answer is no. The book makes that very, very clear. What it also makes very clear is that the relentless pressure on the timetable with new subjects imposed on the curriculum forces history teachers, or history teachers tempted, to abandon a broad chronology and a big picture in favour of unrelated topics. And if Kenneth Clark hadn't bottled that decision all those years ago for history to be compulsory to 16, as everyone was saying, then many of these problems that we're discussing today we wouldn't be discussing. I'll give you one example of that. I have to make a decision as a head of history which GCSE course we offer at my school. Now, the course that we offer is the modern world. Which depth study do we have? Well, we could choose Russia, Stalin. We could choose Germany, the Weimar Republic, and the Nazi regime. There are a couple of others. If we choose the Nazi regime and the Weimar Republic as our depth study for GCSE, should we teach it at Key Stage 3? Because some of my pupils are going to drop history at 14, never study it again. Is it important that they've studied the rise of the Nazis? Is it important that they've studied the Holocaust? Well, up for discussion. But if we decide to teach it in Key Stage 3 because we think it's important, then should we choose a GCSE that doesn't include that? Or should we take pupils even deeper into the subject, broaden their understanding of the topic, more sophisticated, more rigorous in their understanding of these issues? That's something that history teachers wrestle with all the time. And I think bringing it back to history to 16, as this book recommends, in which Mr. Gove this morning seemed open-minded to whether it will actually happen, many of these problems will be resolved.
Thanks, Steve. I want to leave content fairly soon, but if there are one or two comments from the floor first, yes, please.
I understood the point of the question has been missed, because I understood the point of the question to be whether for A-level you should play safe and do something you've done already in greater depth. And some students, given the option, will choose that. And they may be doing 1815 to 84 for A-level because they've done 1815 to 51 already for GCSE, so that chance would be easier. So I think that is the point. You're also driven by results. When you get better results, it's even a bit boring if you're doing the same things over again. So I think that was the point of the question, actually. My own view is do something different for A-level. I really think so. I think you can sell it to the kids. This is something new. It won't be the same old stuff. And so for A-level, we're going to do African Americans. We're going to do the decline of Spain, let's say, or Norman England. There's quite a lot of things that you won't have done for GCSE and may not have ever looked at before. That'll be my advice, but I understand why people may want to take a different route. And sometimes the pressure, with all respect to the same what the kids want, many of the kids will say, well, let's do what sounds easiest. Because we want the result.
Yeah, I mean, I take that point, and I agree, and that's what I would do. Of course, as you say, we do live in a world where results matter, and results drive things, and students will, and parents will, and senior managers in schools, we might get more into later, will push for what is going to get the best grades. I kind of have a slight reticence, though, just about that issue about students having choice. I kind of feel that by the age of 16, if students have studied something and really got into it, and they're choosing to do A-level history as one of their three options, then I don't think it's too, I don't think it's unfair to say to them, so, you know, what subjects do you want to be studying? Because actually, whatever they do, you can give them a good deal on it, and you can go into a lot more detail, because an A-level, even with the current A-level, with only four units, is far more varied than they're going to do at GCSE. So I think I agree in principle. I think the constraints that are placed upon us as teachers, often by senior managers, by league tables and so on, make it very difficult to necessarily push that through.
Catherine? Yeah.
Yes. I want to say to you, don't be afraid of giving your students choice, but I'm coming at it from a different point of view. You know, at primary, then we're encouraging children to choose how they look at different issues within a unit. And to interpret it in many different ways. So I think, you know, maybe as secondary teachers and primary teachers, we should swap roles for a week and, you know, pick up good practice from either side. I don't know. I just fear from, not fear exactly, but quite a lot of the students I've taught over the years have gone on into higher education to study history. And I think students are like sponges. They will, you know, adapt and absorb and enjoy the subjects that are taught well. My fear, perhaps is the wrong word, is that they just seem to do miss pockets of history, in the sense that at the moment, most history, as far as I can see, is at primary school. Then there's some at Key Stage 3, then there may be some at Key Stage 4, and there may be an even smaller slice further on. I would like to be able to talk to them when they come back and see us about a broader range of things that they've studied.
Okay, I want to move on from content to time, but just before I do, just one quick anecdote. I got a new insight some years ago into the content versus skills debate. When I was working in one of the states of the former USSR, I was going on about the history skills, that history was a process of gathering the evidence, of interpreting the evidence, analysing it, and arriving at judgments and making judgments. And one of the members of the audience, who had been brought up in a good Marxist-Leninist school, said, of course, yes, I entirely agree with you, Mr. Hamer. You're absolutely right that history is a process of gathering the evidence and interpreting it and analysing it and making judgments. He said, but we've done all that and we know what the answers are. I said, So why do you want young people to go through this process? So I had to go away and lie down in a darkened room and rethink my position for a while. Moving on, there are a number of questions related to time, and I think, I mean, there would, I guess, there would be broad agreement, if not unanimous agreement, that one of the major issues we face as history teachers is the amount of time or the lack of time that's actually given to the subject. I guess one can almost take that as read. So I think what I would like to rephrase the question slightly, accepting that we need more time to do history, how are we going to find that time in the context of what is already a pretty crowded curriculum? So if we agree, and I'm taking that as read, if we agree that history needs more time, where do the panel think it's going to come from?
Pass.
Sorry.
Difficult, because of course, you know, people who are making decisions perhaps in school, that's one way in which we're going to find the time is to see, is to think about the kinds of decisions that curriculum managers are making, and trying to influence the ways that they make those decisions. We're fairly lucky that we're in a school that does value history and the history department, and we have a reasonable amount of time, certainly compared to schools I've visited elsewhere in the county of Cambridgeshire. Some schools I go to do get perhaps 1 hour a week for 2 years at Key Stage 3. We're a little more fortunate of that, but I think the reason for that is the decisions that the curriculum managers have made, although they're still constrained, obviously, by thinking about the lead tables, and it's been heavily documented how certain schools are able to offer certain options, perhaps more vocational options, to drive up their point scores and therefore look more successful. You know, history is a difficult subject. I think it should be and is accessible to all, but curriculum managers don't always see it that way. And until they make decisions based on values other than point scores and so on, then it's going to be quite a difficult thing to challenge.
Steve?
I would scrap citizenship as head of citizenship. It's not an academic subject. It's not even a subject discipline. What are the core concepts of citizenship? It's not a subject discipline like history or geography or English or maths. It just isn't. Now, for political reasons, it was attached to the curriculum. Some schools teach it as a discrete subject, like my school, which means some other subject lost out, a real subject lost out. There are other schools that teach subjects like learning to learn. I kid you not. Learning to learn, where you look at closed questions, opened questions, you look at the sorts of places where you study and where that is conducive to good study. Well, some subject lost out so that that could become part of the curriculum. Now, where are these decisions coming from? Well, citizenship is part of the national curriculum. So if it was scrapped, deeply unpopular thing to say in some quarters, if it was scrapped, that would allow time for real subjects to teach what we're being asked to teach. Some of the pressures come from the National College for School Leaders, who are encouraging the leaders of schools of the future to experiment with the curriculum, to fiddle with abolishing faculties in schools, to abolish traditional subjects and experiment with competence-based curriculums. For example, the Opening Minds project that the RSA funded suggests that you scrap traditional subjects, you teach them in a competence-based way, where instead of history being taught as history on the curriculum, there would be a theme to that half term, and history would take an aspect of that theme and teach it. So there'd be no sense of chronology or progression in your subject or development to become more sophisticated in your thinking. It would simply be topic-based learning. Now, this is happening in schools now, and a lot of that is coming from the NCSL that trains leaders of the future. It's not coming from history teachers. We're not the enemy. I wouldn't like to say exactly who the enemy is, because I could get into serious trouble for saying that. But if you talk to history teachers, they want time to teach their subject that they love, and they want to inspire pupils to love that subject. And it's as simple as that. And if you give us the time, we'll do it.
Catherine?
Oh, yes, I just want to say I'm very glad I'm working in a primary school where I can be creative with my use of time. I think there are different issues at different stages in the educational system over this. One of the ways that the school I'm working at the moment has approached their planning of the curriculum is that we have five themes for each year group in a year. And at least one of those has to be majorly history led. So it's difficult, and it's getting balance. Some other people argue that, you know, quite a lot of history in primary schools can be done through English, and there are good and negative aspects of that. But certainly, if good history teaching is encouraging oral debate and different points of view and good communication and, you know, raising of questions and arguing, then, you know, that sort of, at a primary level, that can be fed in, you know, at all sorts of areas in the day. So I'm very lucky.
I don't have much more to add, really. I would like to return to David Cannadine's point about making history compulsory to 16. Because, of course, the benefit of that would obviously be to give us more time. I want to just dwell slightly longer, though, on this issue of what's currently the case. Because we've been talking most of today about Key Stage 3 history as if it genuinely is 11 to 14. Now, I would love to teach in a school, and I know there are schools that do this, in fact I taught one previously, where I had 2 hours a week of history for 3 years. And actually, without wanting to, you know, go completely against the idea of compulsory history at 16, I reckon I could teach a really good, you know, solid history course if I had 2 hours a week for 3 years. Unfortunately, that isn't the case in many schools. In many schools, year 7 students won't do subjects, not in humanities. They might do, well, they might do a humanities broad thing. They might do something like opening minds. They might, in year 8 and 9, then be taught by a non-specialist. There are some schools which start GCSE courses at age 13, and therefore only have 2 years of Key Stage 3. So, to my mind, the first step that needs to be taken is to say, well, let's actually get what we've got at the moment right. Let's have 2 hours a week or whatever of history for 3 years with a specialist teacher, and then let's see what we've achieved. And then if it's necessary to then say, clearly that is nowhere near enough time, then we can talk about making history compulsory to 16. My fear is that if we make history compulsory to 16, what's actually going to happen is that a lot of specialist history teachers get taken from year 7 and 8 and moved up into GCSE, and that means you're going to have even more non-specialists teaching lower down the school, and of course then the quality of the history teaching is going to be lost anyway, and there's no net gain. So my line on this is, let's get Key Stage 3 right first. Let's give 11 to 14-year-olds a really good deal in history as history, and then let's talk about other things later.
Could I just follow up? I know that it was said this morning that with 40,000 schools you can find evidence for almost anything, but just to give an insight to a school that I recently visited in the north of our county, they are a school where they have competency-based curriculum in year 7 and start GCSE options in year 9, so that's effectively 1 year of Key Stage 3. But the funny thing was that in year 7, when they were looking for content to deliver this competency-based curriculum, they then turned back to the departments and said, we haven't got anything to teach, is there anything good that you've got? And then the historians said, yeah, we might have a few things, and waded in there and started to deliver the history curriculum again in the way they had. They held it as a success because there was good teaching going on by specialists, but it just made a whole mockery of, you know, what that system was about, because of course getting rid of that particular system would have given time back to those subjects.
There's another question here which is also time related, but it actually in a sense picks up some of the things that Catherine was saying about the position in primary schools to do with the integration of subjects. So the question is, do you think that the teaching of other subjects and the examples which are given here are music and fine art should be involved with the teaching of history. So broadly, I mean, is one of the solutions to the time problem greater integration? I think that's the gist of the question.
I would say that this is a very, very difficult area because it's very, very tempting. You know, if we can say, well, we could teach history and art and music and combine them all at the same time and therefore squeeze it into an hour slot and therefore solve all our problems, you know, that sounds very appealing. My real caution comes from me being a historian and me saying, well, it's actually something distinctive about thinking historically. You know, if we're doing history, we're thinking in a certain way. We're asking questions about why things happened, causal questions. We're asking about how things changed over time. And actually, history as history deserves to be studied in its own right and not watered down. And in the same way as music deserves to be studied as music and geography deserves to be studied as geography. So my first thing is to be very, very sceptical about interdisciplinary approaches simply because of how they can work out in practice. Of course, that doesn't mean it can't work. And, you know, Geraint certainly may want to talk in a moment about how interdisciplinary lessons can be made which actually reflect what is good history, what is good music, good English, good geography, or whatever. But my first question on anything about interdisciplinary goes back to the question of, well, is this going to lead to good history for our students?
Well, I'll come in on that then, because the primary curriculum, of course, is interdisciplinary a lot of the time, hopefully. Yesterday I was talking to some children in Year 5 who'd been studying the Egyptians, which I know people think, why, you know, the Egyptians again. But Egyptians as a topic is fresh to those children when they first learn it. They were walking down the stairs with models in their hands of little things they'd made for... They talked about sarcophaguses, they talked about papyrus, they talked about... because that amazing discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb. And, you know, at primary level, a lot is interdisciplinary, as well as getting children to look at artifact sources. So, you know, I love it.
Enthusiast.
I think pupils naturally see cross-curricular links. I had a group of pupils the other day in a Year 9 lesson where we were looking at the slave trade, and the aspect of spirituals came up, and they looked at that in music. So I was able to use what they'd studied in music in my lesson. We used the music of Thomas Tallis in my lessons about Tudor England, because Thomas Tallis composed music for Henry VIII, Edward VI, Mary I, and Elizabeth I, and he managed to survive intact. An extraordinary fellow. And his music illustrates the ups and downs of the religious upheavals of the period. I think you can do the same with art when it comes to the Spanish Civil War. I think Picasso's painting Guernica is a fantastic way in. Now, I know the painting Guernica, but I'm not an art expert, so I went to the head of art to ask her to talk me through Guernica so I could link with what they were doing in art. Same thing with Bauhaus. Movement in the Weimar Republic, and linking that with what I was doing at GCSE at the time. Now, it's not on the exam syllabus. Why would I teach them something that's not on the exam? I mean, surely my job is just to get them to jump through hoops so they can pass the exam. Well, no, I think my job as a history teacher is much, much broader than that. And if I saw my job as just jumping through hoops rather than seeing the curriculum as something much broader, I'd lose the will to live, I think.
Don't do that just yet. No.
Just to comment on what we were talking about earlier about interdisciplinary work. When I first arrived at a school as an NQT, a newly qualified teacher, I was in a school where they had integrated humanities, and it was a mess. The students or the teachers didn't really understand what the subject was really about and what it was trying to deliver, and it was very confused thinking about the type of disciplinary thinking that was supposed to be going on in the classroom. And there's lots of this issue of episodic bits of knowledge from all of the subjects that were supposedly involved. Having said that, I have run a project recently which was genuinely interdisciplinary. I'm talking here about not just cross-curricular, but trying to use a project to enhance the teaching of both the subjects were involved. It was an English history project, and we were using the novel Private Peaceful by Michael Morfebo, who it's a novel you may well know. And it's a fantastic book, and our English department use it because it's such a fantastic book. What we were doing in the history classroom at the same time, so this is about communicating with that department, was to study, see, the First World War, study the chronology of events leading up to the war, study the war itself. We then do quite a detailed study of local history and look at whether the experience locally reflects the sort of national picture. So doing some really rigorous stuff in history lessons. The project at the end of the, when they were reading in English and they had analysed, and we had written this together, the English and the history teachers had written this together. In the English classrooms, they were analysing different aspects of getting across sense of period, use of dialogue or characters, drama and tension and so on, and the way in which powerful verbs and so on can be used to do that. The culmination of the project was to write another chapter to the story. And what they were having to do was use their rich understanding of history, in particular the sense of period, the diversity of experiences of soldiers and so on. They were drawing on all their understanding that they developed in the history classroom to combine it with what they'd been learning in the English classroom. And the reason that project worked so well is because we were both coming at it from a point of view as a subject specialist and saying, what are the individual subjects about? And so that the planning was around that. And that was successful because to do it well, we had to think about what's this subject, what are we doing this for our own subject.
Can I just come in again there?
Yeah,
I think one of the questions history teachers need to address, and we all need to address as a community, is what do we mean by what is history? Mm. What are we doing? And how active is the learning in history? And where children are particularly involved with drama and debate, that, you know, really lifts things up. And I just want to mention another thing I did a couple of weeks ago, which was take my class to the Lunt, which is a Roman rebuilding of a Roman fort in the Midlands, and they had a wonderful day, just being busy the whole day, and the acting part of that was just outstanding in terms of getting them into a feel of what history can be.
I mean, I'd just reiterate that further and go back to that point about what are the right questions. Because, you know, you could take Shakespeare, and you could teach Shakespeare in drama, you could teach Shakespeare in English literature, you could teach Shakespeare in history. But the questions being asked about Shakespeare in each of those lessons will be different. The way that someone who's interested in drama is interested in Shakespeare is different to what subject specialists in history would be interested in Shakespeare. And I think it's really important to bear that in mind. And of course, what the current national curriculum does very, very well, certainly for history, is it sets out that point of what makes good history. And it comes back to, well, when, you know, certainly academic historians are writing, if you pick a book off the shelf and look at what kinds of questions they are answering, then actually those are summarised in the key concepts of the national curriculum. They're questions of causation. Why do things happen? Change. How do things change over time? Diversity. What are words who have been misinterpreted? It just means similarity and difference. Was everyone the same? How do people experience things differently? Questions of evidence, questions of interpretation. These are what historians do day in, day out. And of course, this is what, therefore, what we're trying to get students to do in the classroom. So to me, I don't mind if there's interdisciplinary work. I think, as Geraint said, it can be very, very powerful and it can, you know, really bring history to life. But I think we have to keep at the forefront, is it good history? And if students are asking the right kinds of questions, then it will be.
Any thoughts, comments from the floor on issues of timing and or integration?
Work well, and I thought that history could tackle the issues of, you know, what the CEO is trying to address more effectively and prove raise profile of history, and put my money where my mouth is and say, this is why history is important, this is why we learn about the past, this is what happens when you use history and historical inquiry to help kids to make sense of the past and apply it to their lives. We did that. I worked with CAMS and they measured, and it's proven that history and doing historical inquiry, looking at where a specific issue was in the area, that was the way to improve children's well-being and it raised the profile of history. You know, because we're going around in circles, I was still looking to prove it out of the
Thank you very much for that. Any other thoughts about how we might try to resolve this time issue? Yes, Ian.
Just to say that the whole issue of time is not something that actually people about the history teacher. At some point, the back of the mind, to get more time on the British. But what is unusual in this country is that we have a national curriculum that requires people to teach certain subjects, but does not include the requirement of schools to allocate those time to those subjects so that you talk properly, whereas most other curricula do such a thing, not in terms of hours a week, usually in terms of time to study. But one of the issues could well be that if you're required to teach a subject on the national curriculum, then there should be a requirement that that subject is given a certain amount of time in which it can be taught.
I completely agree.
Any other thoughts on that before we move on to the next area? Okay, the next area is to do with the thorny issue of assessment. Really, how do we assess, or what is the most appropriate means of assessing history, coursework, essay writing, short answer, etc., etc. So just to ask the panel how they would go about, or what they believe to be the most effective means of assessing children's progress or attainment in history.
Want me to start?
Assessment always has this effect on people. Deadly hush.
Yes, oh, that's a really thorny one, this. At primary, in the school that I work at, we do assess in history, we do report on it annually, but I try to encourage the staff to look at it broadly. So we're not levelling pieces of individual work. We're coming to a general conclusion at the end of each, towards the end of each academic year, how many children we would put at a particular level. And at the moment, our basis is this. It's the old, you know, national curriculum, as opposed to the one that came, was brought in and not taken up by Parliament. And we use these levels as a guide. And to a certain extent, there's a bit of primary teaching gut feeling in it as well. Not that we're doing things without the evidence, but we're not just looking at written work that's produced. We're really trying to assess that child's understanding, and that may well be oral understanding, pictures, drama work, in interpretations, and we still look at the five key elements from the old curriculum as a basis for that. So I will suggest to the teachers that in their assessments during the year, they take one of those key elements and do some individual class list assessments on that child's understanding of chronology over that period of history they've done. So we still use those, helpful or unhelpful, we had this argument before, didn't we, about whether they're descriptors or whether they're attainment levels, but we're still using those a bit. Anybody else?
There is a question later on about level descriptors,
oh,
I see, but
don't ask me that one.
Because I think they're, on the whole, they have very few friends, are they?
Well, it is hard to avoid discussions about level descriptors when I'm being asked this question, because see one answer about what the school assessment looked like is assessment without levels, particularly from the point of view of day-to-day, week-to-week assessment for students. The most important thing for them to understand is what they're being assessed in. So assessment for learning, that what they're being taught is objective-led, that they understand what they're aiming for, But in terms of sort of the assessment that comes at the end of however you're organising a sequence of lessons, whatever the outcome is, so whether it's a piece of extended writing or something else, that the students understand at the end of it what it is they've done well, what area of teaching it focuses on, or area of assessment, what it is they've done well, what it is they need to do to get better. And there are many, many ways of enabling students to understand that, but that's at the crux of good assessment, is whether the student understands what they're learning to do well, and whether they can articulate what progress they've made, and what they need to do next to get better. The issue of how that's achieved is very, very complicated, but I would suggest preempting the question a bit that it's not about the levels, because the levels are not a model of progression in history. They were never intended as such. They're intended to be used as a best fit at the end of hopefully at the end of the key stage, perhaps at the end of a year, once a range of pieces of work have been done and a range of ways of thinking about history have been covered. Teachers need to be engaging in departments with what this issue we've already mentioned, but about what good history is about, what progression in history is about. That's a very difficult discussion to have, and that's what departments need to be discussing all the time, but that should be driving how the assessment is, how history is assessed. You know, rather than looking to the levels for the model of progression, but getting departments to talk about, you know, what is causation all about and how will the students show progress when writing about the causes of the First World War, for example. So engaging with both the content and the disciplinary way of thinking about that content. But departments need to have those discussions in quite a deep level in order to then help the student to the bit that I've started with there, which is them understanding what can we do and what they need to do next.
Having said the questions here, I better actually read it out as well, I suppose, and I so the additional question to couple with the assessment one is, do you think that level descriptors or assessment national curriculum level descriptors or assessment objectives are of any help to either teachers or pupils? And I guess from the way in which the question was phrased, I know what the questioner's answer to that would be, but we'll couple that question with the assessment one.
I don't have much more to add, really, to what Geraint said, because I agree with him. But, I mean, what I would suggest is this. I've got a good history book in my hands here, and we've heard today in the presentation about what made this a good history book, and I haven't read any reviews yet. I'm not sure if anything published, but I'll be very interested to read the reviews, see if people agree with me this is a good history book. But certainly there are other good history books out there. And, of course, that means we're making a judgment within the discipline of history about what is good history. Now, as a historian, I've got a sense of what I think is good history, which will be very similar to what all of us on the panel and probably what most of us in the room think, but of course we're not going to be identical in what we think makes good history. So to me, it does have to be, as Geraint says, an ongoing debate, but it has to be a debate grounded in that question of going back to what do we think is good history and not getting too caught up in, you know, have they used a subordinate clause in order to express their point further. Because you know, I think when you get down to that kind of level, then you get lost in the detail and lose that kind of overall judgment of what makes this good history. Of course, we're not going to answer the question, what is history, let alone what is good history, which is why it has to be an ongoing debate and why judging history ultimately is always going to be a fairly subjective decision. But of course, there's a difference between absolute subjectivism and informed subjectivism. And I'd like to think that all of us could probably make a subjective decision on what is good and what is not good history because we've been trained in the field of history. So to me, if you want to get good historical assessment, then I think it's got to be done by history specialists.
Can I just come in there, though? Oh. I think one of the issues as a sideline along that is that we have lots of students coming out of college and university at the moment who are not specialists for history, particularly at primary. Many of them are having a very short space of their time at university on the teaching of history. And as a body, we need to try and gather up whatever we can to help those students coming into teaching. So the non-specialists, yes, they need some guidance because and they need good nurturing as well. So if we could just try and link, you know, good university history practice within schools, I think that could help. But that is One of my anxieties as I get older towards the end of my career, and I know that, you know, history, when I studied it at what was a College of Education until I did a further degree, distance learning later, the students are just not getting the history time in their education studies.
Obviously, a traditional way of assessing how well a pupil is doing is to set them an essay. Now, the first question a pupil asks you when you say that they're going to write an essay is, how long does it have to be? As if there is an answer to that question.
Not that long.
That long, yeah, exactly. I deliberately don't tell pupils that they're about to write an essay. You build up to it. Because I would say whatever way in which you assess pupils, it needs to include three things. It needs to be rigorous. It needs to be useful to the teacher. There must be some sense of meaning to what it is you're asking pupils to do. And I would say it must be fun for the pupils. Or maybe if you want to use a different word, there must be a sense of satisfaction in doing it. And so when we work up to writing an essay, the pupils have looked at a question from all sorts of different angles, have written notes in a variety of ways. So when you come to answering the question, one of the phrases that they often use, and close your ears here, please, because I don't want to offend you, is I say, we're not going to answer this question in a primary school way. We're going to answer it in a secondary school way. Because you could say, this is the answer to this question, but you've just discovered, year 7, 11-year-olds, that this question is far more complex than that. Because over the last 6-7 lessons, you've seen it from different angles, and therefore, we're going to have to show that when we answer the question. Well, that's all an essay is, isn't it? It's just looking at something from a variety of angles. It's not saying you're about to write something very long. And that's what people have in their mind. An essay is a long piece of writing. It's not. It's a complex, sophisticated answer to a complex, sophisticated question. So however you want to assess, whether it's an essay or another form, I would say it must be rigorous, it must be meaningful, and there should be a sense of satisfaction for the pupils.
Before warfare breaks out in the panel, we'll come back in a minute, Catherine. Okay. Yes, Ben. There's one and then two.
My comment follows neatly on, I think, from Ben's, that it's about what you might think are the purposes of assessment, or what others might feel, who are not historians necessarily, might have wanted the purposes of assessment to be, when there was a long and furious argument about it in this very same hall 30 years ago, when the national curriculum was being mooted, because it may well be that the purpose of assessment, sadly, are to measure something which can go into a league table, which can be valued for all the wrong reasons. So some of the forms and reasons for assessment are, in fact, taken out of our hands, as sometimes the curriculum, you know, has been taken out of people's hands in the last few years.
Thank you. Yes, Burns?
I wanted to ask a question about the assessment big picture and its impact on the entire education system and inevitably on history teaching as well. I was enraptured by Michael Gove this morning because he didn't quite fit with the perceptions of any of the things I've heard him say. I think I heard him say that the assessment tail was wagging the curriculum dog, but I thought I'd also read an incredibly demand for improved standards that would involve another massive grade inflation as people drive up standards by converging with particular assessment objectives. And the impact of that for me is captured by Warwick Mansell, who was a TES education correspondent, who described a lesson he visited on Private Peaceful. And it wasn't about the First World War, it wasn't about storytelling, it wasn't about war poetry, it wasn't about history. It was about which of a number of specimen answers best fitted the criteria that were going to be applied to the marking of that. And it was obvious the teacher had been in an exam board course which had taught him how to assess these in such a way as to maximise the marks. Now, while we are in the headlong pursuit of grade inflation, which devalues all qualifications and all education and does reduce it to education by numbers, thank goodness history teachers can still do something for themselves, but the Secretary of State is speaking with a forked tongue and doesn't seem to even recognise that he's destroying the very project which he's trying to give the greatest authority.
Before I ask the panel if they have any comments on that, is there anything else from the anybody else from the floor? Okay, any thoughts?
I wonder if we have an answer to the question about level descriptors. Have an answer at all with respect to the fact that he's not it. So, or what they think about natural critical level descriptors? It was implied by one of you that you don't think it's terribly important.
I thought it was fairly clear.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, I think the panel was divided from memory at either pole. I think we had one fan of level descriptors and one perhaps less of a fan. But
could I say something? The posters that appeared, I would guess, were senior leadership idea and did not come from the history department.
Absolutely.
Volunteering to put their history levels everywhere. No. So I think that sort of answers your question. Level descriptors, I think, are very, very useful as a guide to thinking about progression across a whole key stage. They're not useful to mark a piece of work about the Battle of Hastings. They're not useful for that. They're not designed for that. So when I'm told to mark a piece of work and give it a national level, a national curriculum level, not only that, but to divide up the national curriculum levels into, well, in my school it's 3 sub-levels. I've heard of some schools it's 6 sub-levels. These sub-levels don't exist. They exist in the ether. So where do these initiatives come from? They come from someone having gone to a National College of School Leaders conference about something or other and think this is going to revolutionise progression in my school. No, it won't. It's yet another thing to whip the history department with. But it's not coming from us. Of course you do. Sorry, I said that out loud, didn't I? Of course you do. They're very useful, the national curriculum level descriptors. As a holistic end of key stage, this is where this pupil is in terms of their progression,
yeah,
not for marking an essay.
Yes, don't worry, Steve, every word you say is being recorded.
I know, I know. I've called for the abolished my subject.
Catherine, did you want to
I wanted to take issue with you. A primary level, I think there's a general, I suppose, yes, I'll fight my corner here. I think that I just wish there was more communication perhaps between secondary and primary, because I think there are misconceptions about the level of understanding that primary children can take on. And through discussions I have not with every child in every class, obviously, but with individuals, and over the years that I've taught, I am astounded at the different levels of maturity and the high skills that the children are able to grasp and take on. I mean, yesterday, for instance, over the Crusades, you know, in a matter of a few minutes, talking to a couple of boys in year six, they were talking to me about struggles of power and motive and how one law led to another and how, and you know, I thought, goodness gracious me, these children can really take, you know, we mustn't see primary history at a primary level. We need to look at the individuals and look at the strengths of the staff and the pupils within those schools. I'm teaching to the converted, aren't
I? No, you are indeed, and I should apologise. I say it for the benefit of my pupils, to make them feel grown
up. Yes, yeah.
Not to disparage primary. And having worked with primary schools in my locality about history, I've seen 9-year-olds do some very impressive things with history, which makes me think, gosh, if 9-year-olds can do that, I'm dumbing down with my 14-year-olds then. So I totally agree.
I wouldn't mind just responding to actually that point and one which was raised on the gentleman on the floor about Michael Gove again. Because one thing that does seem to be coming out of this is this issue of communication. I'm just minded that we're rapidly running out of time here. And I think one thing that's really come out of today as a whole is this need for communication, is this need for people to talk to one another. And I think it's very interesting if you look about the people in this room who have come to listen to the discussion by some history teachers who are there actually doing the job. It's a different audience to the people who were there this morning listening to the historian and the Secretary of State. And I think there does need to be a greater more communication, because a lot of what is said and a lot of the debate happens because of ignorance. It happens because people aren't talking to each other, people don't know. So, I mean, to take the point about Michael Gove saying different things in different contexts, well, I think partly it just comes from the fact that he's misinformed. I think one of the games you might play as history teachers, because we know a bit about history, is, well, let's say Michael Gove, we're going to pick an English king that Michael Gove was most like. Well, I'd be picking Ethelred the Unready. And this is why. Of course, as every good historian knows, Ethelred the Unready's name doesn't come from meaning unready, it comes from the Anglo-Saxon word, excuse my pronunciation, unread, which means ill-counseled. And I think that's what Michael Gove is. I don't think he's an idiot, far from it, I think he's a very intelligent man. And I think a lot of the people who get involved in the debate are very intelligent people, but they're misinformed. They don't know what's going on in the history classroom, they're not talking to each other, and, you know, it's people within the profession are guilty of it as well. Secondary schools and primary schools should be talking to each other more. Historians should be talking more to history teachers. History teachers should be talking more to historians. And politicians should be talking more to all of them. So there needs to be a lot more communication, and that way we might actually push this debate on. One thing that's really come out of David, Jenny, Nicola's book is that actually it's the same debate that's been going around for years and years and years, over a century of the same debate. And this debate isn't going to move on unless we start talking to each other more. If we start talking to each other more, we might get less of a Secretary of State who's unread and more Secretary of State who's well-read.
Just to follow up on that point, it's interesting to see in the conclusion to the book that you know, there is that general feeling and lots of evidence to support it that, you know, the need to raise the standard of discussion, which would hopefully come as a result of that, you know, increased communication, because there is a lot of oversimplification, in particularly in the media, and that's where, you know, some of this scaremongering that's been mentioned is not helpful. And to maybe quote Mr. Gove's words back at him, this trashing of our history teaching has to stop.
Can I just say another thing?
We have 10 seconds.
Can I put a plug in for Midlands History Forum, which meets once a year? And Simon Sharma came to talk to that group this year. And we've got, you know, support here. So I think, you know, he may not be as well informed as he could be, but there are people who are really trying hard to put forward the case for history. And we all need to take responsibility for that.